the screen.
I'll call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is March 31st, 2015. We are convened for the purposes of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5531, the budget bill for the Oregon State Police. Would you like to tee it up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and other member of the subcommittee. We will today hear the budget presentation from the Oregon State Police. On OLIS, there's quite a lot of material. The agency's presentation is the item entitled Senate Bill 5531 OSP Agency Presentation. There's also the governor's budget, there's the legislative fiscal office analysis, and there's the CFO presentation, which is actually titled DAS Presentation, that we will likely get to tomorrow.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Senator Shields, Senator Bates, members of the committee, my name is Richard Evans and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. I've been the superintendent for the Oregon State Police for the last 3 years and I've been with OSP going on my 28th year. It's an honor and a privilege being here today, and I want to thank my employees and staff of the Oregon State Police. We have a lot of folks that do a lot of good work, and unfortunately that doesn't always hit the media, but they put themselves in harm's way every day and do an exceptional job with littler and sometimes odds that most people wouldn't want to face. So I wanted to make sure that they knew how much I appreciate their work. I know the subcommittee also has some difficult decisions. I know, understand the budget restraints, and I want to appreciate, since I become superintendent, the support that I've received from this committee. It's been I've had open conversations, and I want to just take a second to let you folks know how much I appreciate the ability to do that. So I'm going to start out quickly. Talk about the mission, vision, and values of the Oregon State Police. We are the premier public safety service for Oregon. Our mission is of the Department of State Police is to enhance livability and safety by protecting the people, property, and natural resources of the state, and we take that extremely seriously. We have our values. We're guided by our values of pride, loyalty, dedication, integrity, and most importantly, accountability. This is our org chart, and in the past when I presented to the committee, I've done most of the presentation myself, and what I want to do this year is a little bit different. I want the subject matter experts to be here and present what they live for and what they work on yearly. The division directors have a more in-depth view of the programs than I do and probably can do a better job of presenting that information. I have full appreciation that they can do that. One of the things that I wanted to do is, when we talk about OSP, a lot of folks don't understand that we are a full law enforcement agency, and we do a spectrum of work. We're not a highway patrol. We're one of the only state police agencies that has a fish and wildlife department underneath it. But when you look at us from a totality, from what we affect in the public safety system from the very beginning to the very end, you'll hear about it. It's non-existent in the rest of the United States. Our folks do extremely good work. One of the things that I wanted to do to try to explain that to you is the only way I felt like I could do that, I could talk about what the divisions do, but I asked the major to take a summary of the events of the week of March 15th through 21st and talk a little bit about what we responded to or handled in that week. It started out, to be honest with you, with 13 pages of events. We condensed it down to 7, and I wanted to give you just a few of those just to realize what we do. A lot of folks, I think of the state police. They think of speeding tickets, motor vehicle crashes, and DUI arrests, but we're much more than that. One of the first ones I'll talk about is OSU. We had a subject, male subject, attempting to break into dorm rooms at the university. And this, for the record, this all happened the week of March 15th through 21st. That subject, our Troopers located that person, found out he was a suspect in another sexual assault inside of Corvallis, and that subject was apprehended and charged with numerous burglaries, numerous rapes, or an attempted rapes, and sex abuse. And that was in OSU. In Roseburg, we had a trooper on I-5 tending to a crash. When he was tending to the crash, he had another vehicle pull right into the middle of the crash scene. The driver get out of the vehicle and go to the passenger side. Get into the vehicle. The trooper went over and said, "Hey, I need you to move your car." And that person said, the female that got out into the passenger seat said, "I wasn't driving, basically, and the passenger was beating on me, and I'm not going to do what you say." Ended up being a DUI arrest. Ended up fighting the trooper. And basically endangered everybody's lives by stopping right in a traffic lane. We had another one in Roseburg where a driving complaint came in of a female driving with her child down, a 13-year-old child down I-5, and a truck was tailgating her as they were coming down the mountain. The person got scared, drove 8 to 10 miles forward at a high rate of speed. The truck caught up to her, got in the lane beside her, and forced her off the roadway into the median. That subject was arrested for several crimes, but that's just in the Roseburg area. And I could go through this list with you, and there's stabbings out in Cave Junction where we have pursuits, where stabbings, assault ones, numerous suspicious deaths. We had three SWAT call-outs that week where folks in mental health crisis began shooting at the police. It ended up resulting in no shots on our part, but taking those situations and de-escalating them. So I can provide the list to the committee, but I just want you to understand that we do everything, full service, and a lot of the calls that we go to are at the request of our other public safety partners. 10-year overview. One of the things I wanted to talk to the committee about is what my view in law enforcement is in the last 10 years, and it continues to change pretty dramatically. Technology in law enforcement, especially for us, has changed drastically in the last few years. We've moved to electronic sites, electronic crash reports where we're filled out and filed at the scene. We've moved to MDTs, which you'll hear in our technology presentation. We've moved away from folks within OSP seeing a problem and making their own software, hardware out of Excel spreadsheets, for lack of a better term, to more commercial broad-based systems. And then the use of video cameras in all our patrol cars to record what's going on out there. And public trust in law enforcement is extremely important, and we have the ability to record, I would say, 95 to 100% of our incidents that happen. One of the things that we'll always talk about is our lack of adequate resources and instability in the general fund. Since we were taken out of the general fund in 1980, we've had a trend in troopers that has been a straight reduction. We have 334 allocated troopers today, and that is about half of what it was in 1980. And one of the things that I think we always need to point out, and we'll get to it in a slide, that the state police is about 70% general fund. So anytime there's a general fund cut or reduction, it affects us a lot more heavily than agencies that don't have as much general fund. The county funding, I know that Senator Bates is well aware of what's happening in some of our counties in rural Oregon, but we're the stopgap law enforcement agency, and we're responding to numerous calls for service in these counties. And what's most troubling is that it's just not a lack of law enforcement in the counties. You have a lack of jail space. You have a lack of prosecution. We have cases where we come to a crash scene, the car is stolen, the person's wanted, they have drugs on them, and we issue them citations and let them go. Obviously, you have no accountability, and the crime is going to continue until somehow that is addressed. What this has done is the silver lining or gold lining behind that is we've created partnerships in law enforcement that we haven't had in the last 10 years. I meet with the sheriffs, I meet with the chiefs, I meet with the DAs, constantly trying to make sure that we are providing the best service that we can to the citizens of Oregon and pooling our resources and making sure that when other law enforcement officers or deputies or city police officers are not available, we have state troopers available. That doesn't always work the best, but in a place like Curry County, we work really hard in trying to maintain the public trust in that if they do call 911 or if they do have an emergency, somebody's going to show up. It might take them a while to get there, but we're going to show up. The public opinion on law enforcement, I can tell you, as I've been in this business for the last 27, 28 years, is that the trust in law enforcement has eroded. What you see is what is portrayed in the media is that law enforcement has use of force issues, public trust issues. There's a thin blue line. Police officers do not. When they see bad actors, do not bring that issue forward. And the one thing that I will share with you in a couple minutes is we have been tracking our use of force stats for many years and our race-based policing for many years, even though we were not required to do that. And I have the stats today to show to you on what we actually keep track of and how we compare to the census of Oregon. And I'm very proud that our numbers are very good, and we've been, I tried to think back, how long ago in my career did we start doing this? And I can't even remember. It's so ingrained in me that when we do make a stop, we do keep the stats for why the stop was made and if what the race of the person was in the enforcement action at the end. It's second nature from us, but the numbers that we can generate to show how we police in Oregon, I think you'll be impressed with those. The KPMs that we're required to report on, we will go through those with each individual division and go in those in depth so that you can hear exactly where we're meeting. But if you look at the five KPMs that are in red, crash reduction, coverage with trooper availability, traffic stops leading to arrest, forensics turnaround time, and then with our fire marshal fire safety trainings, the anomaly is it's about resources and our ability to do our job. And, you know, I'm not going to say that's anybody's issue, but when we don't have a trooper available to go to a call for service, we try to maintain that we hit certain levels and we have that ability to respond. I will tell you that fatals, as the committee has heard in the past, is on a national downward trend, injury crashes and fatals. However, in Oregon is the first year, and I can remember my career, that they rose from 313 fatalities to 350. Pretty substantial increase in Oregon. The numbers, when you hear the Patrol Services Division captain speak, we don't have the totality of the numbers yet. It takes about a year for ODOT to break those down between whether they occurred on state highways, county roads, or secondary highways. But I will tell you, the fatal motorcycles crashes increased by 32% last year. I have a theory about that, and my theory is that we are getting so many calls for service on I-5 because of cell phones. Cell phone, we get numerous cell phone calls of this guy cut me off, this guy's speeding, there's a drunk driver, that the troopers really have to maintain patrols on I-5 just to keep up with the calls for service. We have so many secondary highways that we're not able to get to patrol. If we have two troopers right now on duty in Salem, they will be responding to calls for service on I-5 and doing no proactive police work. It's all reactive police work. And so when those numbers come in, my expectation or my thought as I watch through the year, that a lot of those will be on secondary Oregon highways where the patrol presence, like in Curry County, is non-existent. Those troopers are responding to calls for service. I also want to remind the committee that we're not 24/7 operation anywhere in the state, and we haven't been for a while. So between the hours of somewhere between midnight and 2 a.m. and 6 to 8 a.m. in the morning, oftentimes there's no troopers on duty anywhere in the state of Oregon. We can't maintain that under the normal, the amount of troopers that we have available. They are called out when a call for service comes in, and they're called out to those, and we have one of our priorities in what we're trying to attempt to do is get patrol cars for every trooper. Some folks have thought that that would be not a real requirement, but if we're not going to have 24/7 coverage, if a trooper gets a call for service and at 2 o'clock in the morning he has to respond to his office, pick up the car, and then respond back to the call for service, oftentimes passing the call for service on his way. And if you're in need of a trooper at 4 in the morning, you don't want to have to wait a half hour to an hour for that trooper to respond. So we've put that in our budget package as a priority, and we continue to work internally toward that priority. The policy option packages listed above, you have them. 90 is 20 additional troopers, a moderate amount of troopers, hoping that we could add those troopers, the additional vehicles. We were looking for 33 vehicles this biennium. We've had some internal savings, and we're down to 31 vehicles that we believe we need. We've taken some of the internal savings and purchased some additional vehicles, trying to reduce that number, trying to meet that number as soon as possible. The ballot measure 91 that we've had discussions about in the past is the marijuana ballot measure.
Oh, the House members are still on education.
We are continuing to work with OLCC and the legislature on what that really will look like. I get a lot of questions about ballot measure 91, and until it's in its final status, I'm not sure how that's going to affect us or how we will enforce that. But we will continue to keep you updated on that. Criminal, I just talked about that. Forensics, another infrastructure improvement. And then ballot number measure 91 calls for an additional scientist to process the increased, what we believe will be increased urine samples resulting from arrests from DUI and additional marijuana. The CGIS improvements, infrastructure, crime view is a big project that we talk about improving. It is the mainframe for all public safety agency information. It's very outdated. It's a single fail system, and we are attempting to invest money. We're a sole provider for that. It includes the criminal histories of Oregon, the wants records, the restraining orders. All of the criminal information data is held in that, and it's accessed by all our partners across the state and across the nation. So it's extremely important that that system stands on its own. Ballot measure 91, we talked about fish and wildlife is the ballot 090, the general fund. The governor's recommended budget calls for $5.2 million in general fund to offset the $5.2 million ODFW shortfall. This is a concern that we have. The fish and wildlife troopers do an excellent job in their main job, but also they're a safety net in our rural communities to respond to calls for services that if they're on duty and there's a call for service that it's a priority call, they can respond and stabilize the scene. They're full duty police officers until a trooper can respond to take care of that. So they're extremely important. And in places like Curry County, they outnumber our regular patrols, the fish and wildlife folks. And so we're really concerned about that. If you look at since 1980, I think we've lost about 2% of fish and wildlife as they remained a dedicated fund. And we've lost over 50% of the patrol since they've moved into dedicated funding or away from dedicated funding. So that obviously concerns me greatly if we go to another general fund patrol, basically, or a subsequent patrol in fish and wildlife, they'll continue to be reduced and our impact on rural communities will be affected by that.
Question.
Yes, so
on the ODFW revenue, is it because of fees? Is it because what's the reason that you're seeing the reduction in the revenues to you?
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, members of the committees, from my understanding, and I have Captain Samuels who will come up and testify on the Fish and Wildlife, from my understanding, their revenues are down because of less fishers and hunters, and so they have to share that impact. And so in the governor's recommended budget, they decided to backfill that $5.2 million in general fund instead of the revenues out of licensing and hunting fees. Our proposed legislative concepts, some of you are aware of some of these. House Bill 2433 is the e-citation format, as I talked about earlier. There is actually a statute that requires the citations be of certain size. Well, the certain size doesn't actually print in a e-citation format. And so we're trying to adjust the business practice or the law to the business practice. We aren't the only ones that use e-citations. Numerous law enforcement agencies are able to download this information straight from the traffic scene to the court system, which is a more effective, but under the technicality, they should be a different size. And so we're trying to correct that. Senate Bill 237 is a our OSAC, which is the Boxing Wrestling Commission. Boxing has evolved greatly in the last few years to where it used to be the George Foreman and Muhammad Ali, and now it's MMA and cage matches, and the bill and the laws around that have not been updated, and so it's more of a house cleaning. We have more MMA mixed martial art fights than we do boxing events in Oregon nowadays, so we're trying to update that. House Bill 2432 is brought to us by the Fire Marshal. There are a lot of our folks out there, constituents, that wanted the ability to repel the geese, basically, from their fields, golf courses, and to protect some of their agricultural crops. And so this actually expands the use of fireworks. One of the questions that I got initially, is this going to hurt the birds? No. It's a common practice, and it just expands that practice. As you know, the geese populations, if you look out your window, continue to increase in the Willamette Valley and other places in Oregon. House Bill 2429 repeals the sunset, and it's basically the relief petition for firearm purchases. This was a co-sponsored bill, basically, by the PSRB in an attempt to put into law what the legislature previously enacted, and it basically gives the folks ability to own and purchase a firearm based upon their past. Senate Bill 236 authorizes the state police to purchase property. I became superintendent 3 years ago, and when I talk to members of this committee, it's extreme. They always talk about saving money and looking for avenues within the department to find efficiencies. The fact of the matter is the state police have been around since 1931, and we continue to pay on leases and property around the state that we do not own. It is very common in our local areas for an office to have a lease for 4 years and then move to another location and then move to another location. That's costly. The public does not know where the police offices are. And for us, if we would have began buying property back in 1931, I use Pendleton as an example. There's several places on the three exits for Pendleton that if we'd have bought property many years ago would have been paid off, the building would have paid off, and we can invest that money back into troopers in the local area. And the cost savings is pretty significant in owning property. I know that several other state agencies have the ability to own property, but our blueprint around Oregon constantly changes, and it's very costly for us. And so this is a cost-saving measure that if we could do this, we could actually start saving money and reinvesting money, or giving you the ability to say, we want those extra dollars that you saved to be put into patrols in this area or another area of the state. So I'm extremely supportive of that. House Bill 2430 is an internal bill that allows us to accept monies from other agencies and pass those through, distribute grants that we are already doing. It's more of a house cleaning. We do distribute grants to other agencies for the state police. And House Bill 2431 changes the physical testing requirement set by the department. We haven't changed those since 1931 in their Army standards. And the Army standards are not what is used in law enforcement in basically Oregon or the nation. And we have actually had Division I NCAA athletes come in that have played on football teams in University of Oregon and Oregon State and failed our tests. And so we also have noticed that some groups of citizens of Oregon have a difficult time with some of the tests. And what we're trying to do is make sure that that we give a test that is fair, equitable, and we get the right people through the door, consistent with other law enforcement practices. I don't want to create barriers. The fact of the matter is I'm not hiring soldiers. I'm hiring citizens of the community, and the difference between 25 and 24 sit-ups will probably not dictate whether you're a good police officer or not. And so I want to get rid of that, the standard, come up with a standard that's fair and equitable and does not discriminate or does not keep folks that I know would be exceptional police officers from joining the department. I'm gonna have Colin Nealand, our Chief Financial Officer, cover the budget slides. He's much more knowledgeable about the budget and in-depth if you have any questions, and then I'll close in a few minutes. Colin?
Sure.
Sorry about that, Art.
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Colin Nealand, and for the record, I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of State Police. And I will go through the next few slides that go over the agency's budget as recommended by the governor for the 2015-17 biennium. The first slide you have in front of you provides an overview of the way the agency is organized by division. And so this is an all funds look for the 2015-17 biennium. And so you can see what percentage patrol is and then the other divisions that we have within the agency. And then as the superintendent has already mentioned, we are primarily a general fund agency. And as you can see here in the governor's budget, we would be at $274 million of general fund, which is approximately 70%. Of course, that differs by divisions. We have some divisions which are, if not 100% other funds, they are almost 100% other funds. A good example of that would be our State Fire Marshal Division, where we have other divisions such as our patrol or forensics divisions that are closer to 90% or more general fund. But on when we look at the agency overall, we're what you see here at basically 70% general fund. And then,
sorry, so I'm interrupted. On your funding, do you know when you do background checks and crime view, do you charge for crime view to other agencies and other people, and do you recover at least your cost on background checks?
Yes. So Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, yes, we do charge other agencies. It's we call it our regulatory program within our Criminal Justice Information Services Division, and we do recover our costs within that, and we actually also use those costs to offset some of the more general programs that we have within that division as well.
Background checks?
Yes.
Can you see, can I see the numbers on that later on?
Yeah, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, yes.
Okay, definitely. Thanks.
Senator, aren't there some organizations, though, that don't really cover or pay the cost for the background checks? I don't want to leave the good senator with the understanding that all of the organizations and groups actually do pay, so you might want to explain those who do not.
Sure. So, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, Senator Bates, to Senator Winters' point, there are folks that when we do background checks by statute that we actually waive those fees. So one example of that would be for folks that work for a volunteer organization. And if they're a part of an organization, then they submit a request to us by statute. We actually waive both the fees that we charge as well as any fees that we would incur for doing an FBI background check as well.
So, Mr. Chair, you might want to include the amount mm-hmm. that actually that you don't receive remuneration for.
We will be sure to do that.
Well, thank you. And if you can get it to the professional staff, she'll distribute
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And so, members of the committee, what you have here is the 10% reductions as all agencies are required to do. This is simply part of putting the budget together to put together a 10% list of reductions on our general fund and lottery funds, and then also our other funds and federal funds. And so these are the programs that were included in the budget information that you have in front of you. As if we had to take a 10% reduction on our general fund and lottery funds, what programs within the department would be impacted by that? And then this is the same information on the other funds and federal funded programs that would be impacted if we had to take a 10% reduction. The only real difference here for the other fund and federal fund programs is that we are at this time not expecting to have any revenue issues within our other fund and federal funds. So we would not anticipate at this time having to actually enact any of these reductions. And then lastly, the last slide I want to talk to the members of the committee today was our long-term vacancies. And so what you see here are the vacancies that the agency had at the end of December 2014. We do this on a quarterly basis, and so this was the last quarter that we had this information available. And you can see how many positions we had vacant, both at longer than 6 months and also longer than a year.
So one of the things that I wanted to cover, thank you, Colin,
sure.
Is the law enforcement hot topics and some of the issues that I see being discussed about law enforcement across the United States, and wanted to kind of talk a little bit about what the state police does and what we have been doing for a while. It's very clear to me from the Ferguson, Missouri issue and other issues across the United States that the trust of law enforcement and the ability to produce some of the statistics has not been there. But as I said earlier when I talked, I can tell you that we've been tracking this information for quite some time. So I asked my staff to put together some population data from the U.S. Census and then the percentage of folks that we stop. And what I found was what I believe to be true is that the population in Oregon is 77% white. We stop 83% white. That's the only one or race that we actually stop higher than the U.S. Census. The Hispanic population in Oregon is just over 12%. 9% of our enforcement stops are Hispanic. African American population is 2%. We are at 1.8% on our enforcement stops. Asian population in Oregon is 4.1%. Our percentage of stops is 2.1%. And then other and Middle Eastern, we track Middle Eastern. The census is a little different. It talks about other. The population is 2.3%, and we have a 1.1% population on that stop. The last category is Native American, and the population in Oregon is 1.8%, and we stop 0.4%. So the only overrepresented race that we have in our stop data versus race is the white. We've been working on this data for quite some time and participated in the LECC that the legislature is talking about getting back together. We have provided our data to LECC for many years. There were only, I believe, four or five agencies in Oregon that did that, and we had that data and we presented it to them. So, like I said, we track this data, and I wanted to present it to you that on our racial profiling numbers, they're very low or in accordance with the populations.
Senator Winters.
Just a question, because just looking at Ferguson and even looking at Portland, it appears, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that across the country, you don't hear state troopers. You hear about the local police department, the city police departments. So what is it in the training and what have you that occurs with the state troopers across this country that does not occur? Or what are the culture that does not actually be in your city municipalities? Because if I look at whether it's New York, whether it's Ferguson, whether it tends to be the municipalities. So can you help us?
Senator Winters, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, I think policing a stable city police department is extremely different than a interstate highway or some of the other cities. I will tell you that we spend a lot of training time with our troopers, and they're required to tell the person the reason that they stopped them, identify themselves, and we have a policy on recording the conversation, which promotes accountability. I don't know what some of the other agencies talk about when they train, but I will tell you that if somebody calls in on a complaint, we will look into the complaint. We even accept anonymous complaints. We don't need a signed complaint. We will look into the complaints and we try to investigate those. Public trust is the one thing that if we don't have, we might as well not be there. So it's extremely important, and we talk about that in our culture, that the public trust and treating everybody the way you want to be treated is extremely important. And they hear me talk about that all the time. It may not be your family member, but it may be somebody else's family member that you're dealing with, and that's kind of the culture that we create in our agency. I have some experience with that. I was on the committee, on the use of force committee in Multnomah County, and I went to the four public meetings and sat on the board and listened to the citizens of Portland, and at almost every meeting they said, I don't want to talk to you, there's no reason for you to be here. It made me proud, but I did get to hear the difference in the relationship between the inner city police departments and some of the citizens there. And I got to be honest with you, it concerns me, because I want to make sure that Oregon law enforcement maintains a great the reputation that we have, and to continue to work forward to solutions so that we can gain the public trust, whether that's in Burns or North Portland. Even though there were state police, I think it's extremely important.
I just found it interesting across the country that when you look at the issues, you know, there used to be, there was some problems in California, but basically most of them are inner city. Most of them have to do with municipalities and not with state troopers. So it just begs the question that both the training of state troopers as well as the management of state troopers and what's required tends to be different, if you will.
Thank you.
Superintendent, yesterday in House Judiciary, we held a hearing on our profiling bill. Okay. And I'm wondering if you can provide that data to me. We're asking that a data collection be done around profiling. And so I would be interested in looking at what you collect, how you collect it. That would be really helpful.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, I will get that to you immediately. We have a report and a summary.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thanks. A couple of things. Can you tell me how you collect the data? Is it every traffic stop that you collect data on, or is it a sampling? How does that work?
Representative Gorsuch, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, it's every contact. And it's not a stop. It's any contact.
Any contact.
Any contact. And that would be if I stop you for walking down the street just to talk to you based on reasonable suspicion of a crime, we would. Log that data. There was a time when we even logged the if I asked you for a consent search, a probable cause search, or any type of other expansion of the stop, we were tracking that, and then whether the results of those searches determined whether we found something or not. And so we it's not just the stop, it's every contact that we make.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
I'm going to go back to racial profiling just for a second.
Yes, sir.
Two questions. Do you know if a city, especially city, but county also keeps track of statistics the way you do as far as arrests or stops, I should say, not arrest? And I think you're being, there's something different in your culture. I have friends of color who travel from Portland to Medford to see me. They automatically add an hour to the trip because they know they're going to be stopped somewhere along the way routinely. Once in a while, they don't get stopped. They usually get stopped. And they're not, it's on I-5. They're not being stopped by the State Patrol. They're being stopped by sheriffs, and they're also being stopped by when they go through a city, by the city police. And they're usually pulled over, questioned, and then released, and then they drive on down. But it's different. You've developed a culture that's different somehow, and I'll not go back to what Senator Winter asked. I think you're being modest about this, which I appreciate, and I know your patrol areas are different also. You're not working downtown areas that are, you know, a lot of poverty and everything, but there's something different here. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about why you're different than other organizations. If you don't know, that's fine.
Senator okay. Bates, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, I will tell you that the people that we hire, we do an extensive background investigation. And like I said, any complaint can be taken, and accountability is not something that it's not a word we expect it. And we hold our folks accountable if they do make a mistake. And I think that tends to lead to folks to believe that, or this is the culture that they buy into and the way they act. I also believe that the way we conduct professional stops and, you know, introduction, the reason that you stopped them and tell them it's recorded is extremely important. Some agencies don't require that. They don't require the name on the uniform, which we require. There's a lot of different reasons for that, but we are very strict in that if I stop you, I'm going to tell you the reason and give you your options and ask you if we have a process that we teach everybody, and we will ask if there's any legal justification for any reason, simply on a speeding ticket. Sir, you're traveling 75 and a 65 today. Identify myself and then say, is there any reason or lawful justification for the speed today? They could be going to a hospital. They could have somebody hurt. We give the people the opportunity to tell us the reason that they are doing what they're doing, and that tends to lead to more of a professional contact instead of the, do you know why I stopped you or something like that. That is not in our operating standard. And if somebody was doing that, we would catch it pretty quickly. That's not the expectation that we set. So I think it starts there. And one of the questions that my staff always gets from me is, if you were in a similar set of circumstances, is that the way you wanted to be treated? And we try to permeate that through the agency, whether that's stopping to fix somebody's tire, if that was your family member, to if you have a citation coming, that doesn't mean that you're a bad person. We don't need to demean anybody. It's an enforcement action, and we will take the right action. I think that's probably the culture that permeates some of that. I appreciate the comments. We work hard at it. But, you know, the other thing I have to say is I haven't worked in an inner city. I didn't work for an Oregon Portland Police Bureau or Chicago PD or anything like that to even understand that environment. So that would be putting, like, asking me to interpret that. It would be very difficult because I've never done it. I don't know.
Thank you.
Yes. In addition to the basic or the training that's done by DPSST, do you have periodic training of your officers, and how frequent? Because one of the things that in talking to DPSST about this whole issue, and where there's the basic training and yet the individuals go back to their respective communities, and if their supervisors or managers haven't kept up to date and current, you know, that could pose some issues and some problems in changing the culture. So I just wonder how you've, managed to do it. Because honestly, like I said, you do not hear this issue in any large degree to state troopers.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Winters, we do have mandatory training. We require defensive tactics training. We require patrol tactics training. And we have, prior to the academy, a month of training that is just for our troopers. And then after the academy, we have another month and a half of training that is just for our troopers. So we have the additional front end, the back end, and then we maintain our training. Even when budget issues get low, we continue to mandatorily have that training and to continue. And so folks say, well, you work on use of force. The whole object is to not use any force. And so our training, we try to focus on that issue instead of just the use of force.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I remember I grew up in the St. Louis area, and there was just a couple of years back, there was an incident where a kind of a wealthier suburb hired a Missouri highway patrolman to run the department and be chief of this small municipality in this wealthy suburb. And the allegation was that the mayor instructed the police chief to racially profile, and he said, I'm not going to do it, and became a whistleblower and put his whole job and potential history or future on the line, and just said, no, I'm just not going to do it. And he got terminated and just drew a line in the sand. Not that I was telling.
Senator Bates, I just want to address the first part of your question, which was what departments, how they collect data, do they collect data? Mm-hmm. In our hearing in House Bill 2002 yesterday, we talked about, and there are amendments coming that will amend that bill to have a consistent reporting requirement for all law enforcement agencies in Oregon. Data collection, retention, and analysis at Portland State, and a committee to look at that data and see what we need to be doing and where we need to be investing and where our real problems are in racial profiling. So that's coming.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Something has become a real problem in certain parts of Southern Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I get regular complaints about it. It's not state police.
Right.
And I think the county's going to change tap now because our new sheriff is a man of color, and he's aware of it. And so we've just got a couple of cities we have to work with. But thank you for that information. Appreciate it.
Members of the committee, Senator Bates, I'm sorry I didn't get to that. Back in the – we've been – submit. We were involved in LECC, but I only believe there were three other law enforcement agencies that were submitting data to LECC. I think Corvallis PD and several other agencies, but it was voluntary for the other agencies. And so I don't believe that, as Representative Williamson talked about, a lot of agencies are tracking their data, would be my impression. And some of them may not even have that capability built in to that system or a system of systems yet. I don't know that, but that would be my personal guess.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, just to, since we're having this full discussion, then I would think that it's going to take also some educating and some training once we do start the data tracking.
Yes.
It might not be such a bad idea of maybe having some consultation with the good, with our good chief sitting over here, you know, because actually, you know, when I look and talk about culture and change, you know, if you already have a leader existing, an organization that has been doing it for years and years, it's sometimes helpful to have them to actually educate and train others. There's also another piece that I think, and you didn't talk about, because it's sort of like the difference when you have a scout, and I always knew why Governor Attia always loved state troopers. You know, the state troopers and their high standards have always existed ever since I've known, and you can go back to 1931, and so there's a certain pride that exists with the state troopers that I think that is inherent. And I've seen someone out there looking at me, so I'm not signing up to be a part of state. I'm not going to be a trooper, but I do think that there's a quality and there are some standards there that could be adopted in some of our other law enforcement communities. And I'll say no more about it.
So the next thing I want to talk about, use of force statistics. We have been tracking these for quite some time, and between 2012 and 2014, we had over 620,000 enforcement contacts, which resulted in 313 use of force incidents. And of those 313 use of force incidents, over 65% of those were physically taking you into custody or threatened use of a taser. And so if you look at our enforcement contacts, if you have contact with a state trooper, the odds of you getting in a use of force incident are 0.05%. Or one in every 1,981 contacts. We do train on use of force regularly every quarter, but the whole goal of use of force training is to not use force and find other ways to handle the situation. You know, one of the things that I hear in the media is that, you know, law officers want to shoot citizens or they want to get in a fight. You know, I've worked in numerous locations around the state: Portland, Central Point, Grants Pass, Albany, Pendleton, Hermiston, and I never worked with anybody that wanted to go get in a fight or get or shoot somebody. In fact, it was the other way around. I had more officers that would shy away from that than actually get involved in it. And the public perception that you want to shoot somebody. I understand where it comes from, but in my personal experience, it's the last thing that anybody wants to have happen when they're out on patrol. Our use of force statistics are below the national averages, and I will tell you that comes from training on use of force and making sure that we continue to monitor our incidents. And the one way that we've done that since I've become superintendent is video cameras in every car. I call it plug-and-play law enforcement. We get numerous complaints where, hey, this guy called me this, that, or that. Well, let's watch a videotape together and see if that happened. And those complaints are easily either documented or not documented. And plug-and-play law enforcement, I think, is the wave of the future. I think that the public has an expectation that a contact between a citizen and law enforcement will be recorded somewhat, and that they have the ability to play that back. So we have the system. We went from, when I first got here, we had a DVD or a system that was not DVD-based. It was server-based, and we had issues with that. And we went simply back to a DVD-based model that actually will record prior to the officer turning the lights on. And even if the officer didn't turn the lights on, if a significant event happens, we can get the information off the hard drive of the vehicle and save that data. So that is one of the reasons. One of the problems with that, and I will tell you this for us right now, is public records requests. Mm-hmm. The more data that we have, the more public records requests that we get. And some of these public records requests are very vague and they're very encompassing. They will not be specific to an officer. They'll ask for a use of force incidents that involved male troopers on FEMA for the last 2 years. Those are really difficult for us to keep up with. And so what I fear is that when we move to technology, and as technology moves, you'll hear about body cams with our fish and wildlife guys because they have cameras in their trucks, but a lot of times they're away from their trucks out in the woods. And so we're trying to get a way to capture that, is that these public record requests will inundate our records committee and or our folks, and we just, the number just keeps increasing, and so that's something for the legislature to continue. Recruitment and retention. Before the issues that have hit the media back in September of 2013, I began working with the Governor's Office, Inclusion and Diversity Office, to look at our hiring practice from start to finish to make sure that there were not any issues that we weren't aware of, and go through each step and break down the steps to make sure that our background, recruiting, and retention of all folks and minorities, there were not any hidden or built-in bias in that. And what we found out is we were very rigid in some of our application dates and times, training dates and times. We'd set a physical test and we'd only allow it at one certain time in one certain location, and folks couldn't make those, so they'd be eliminated from the database. So we've basically worked really hard to try to accommodate and be more flexible, allow different groups. But one of the things that I talked about earlier that came out of the recommendations is the physical test, and working on that. We're also looking at making sure that our written test is not inherently biased. We don't believe it is. We didn't intend it to be, but somebody that actually will work through the process, an independent person, will tell us whether that is or not. We're going to work through that process. And then we've also started using social media. We've started, kids are different than they are today, younger folks. We've started using Twitter, social media, some of the ways to recruit applicants to make sure that we are getting out to the folks that we haven't got to in the past. And we continue to work through this issue. And I'm hoping that during the next session, we report back, we would have completed this process, and I can report to you on the difference or non-difference that we're making. We've also went to several different events that are minority-based in recruiting efforts, trying to do a little more outreach than we have in the past, because that was obviously missing. The fact of the matter is the state police could open the website, Recruit for Troopers, and I could get thousands of applications without leaving the office. But that doesn't mean that's the 1,000 applications that are going to be the best troopers or culturally diverse. So we're trying to work on that internally on our own. So I will hopefully be able to report back some more findings on that as we move forward.
As you begin to look at ways of doing recruitment, and not only you, but I think other law enforcement community, have you thought in terms of actually maybe building a team, because you're also having to build relationships, of going, do some presentation, and I'm looking at high schools now, because often we wait until the individuals are adult and we start recruiting. And I know we found when I was on the U.S. Air Force Academy board that we had to begin to do the presentation and education early on to give young people the idea and the concept of something to work towards and what have you. And I don't know with you and the other disciplines of maybe thought, because twofold, it's actually letting young people know really the real story of what you do, and two, trying to get them interested in joining whichever force, whether it's the city or the state troopers, and that might be a thought in that direction.
Senator Winters, co-chairs Williamson, co-chair Shields, funny you mentioned that. Retired member Jim Willis, retired veterans, he just reached out to me from the Boy Scouts of America, and we're going to start putting together a summer camp at DPSST with DPSST's cooperation to try to get teenage folks from the communities around Oregon that are interested in law enforcement, bring them in and do a 1 or a 2 week camp We haven't figured out how we're going to recruit those individuals, but I believe that there's other programs in other states across the United States, and the hiring rate of those individuals into law enforcement are a lot higher than the normal public. They see what is really going on, and they invest, and they want to finish high school and do well. So we're looking at that program. I know it'll be a cost, and out of our budget, I've told Captain Anderson, who would be over that program, that we will absorb the cost. DPSST has volunteered their facility for that purpose. And so we are moving forward as a group, as I talk about collaboration, trying to get some of those kids. And in fact, one of our ideas was to reach out to the legislators in the areas about kids that they believe are possibly at risk or in the communities out there that we could maybe give a little bit of structure to or show them what a trooper, being a trooper, entails, or a police officer. So we are working on that program. We're hoping to have it up by August of this year. It's pretty in a short period of time, short turnaround, but we're working toward that goal.
Senator Shields.
You read my mind, Superintendent Evans. I was thinking that, you know, most of us probably have 4,000 or 5,000 people on our email list and could be a good source for helping you spread the word about enrollments.
And Madam Chair, I certainly hope that you reach out to the female, the other part of the genders as well.
We're going to do our best to get a diverse group of folks around Oregon. And, you know, I know folks in Salem area, but that's, I want to encompass all of Oregon when we do this. And I know this is, if we do it right, it'll be a program that we're going to have too many applicants for the amount of spots that we have. That's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Senator, just so you know, Representative Gorsuch had a bill. We're changing it slightly to hire two people out of DPSST to be, I don't know, for lack of a better term, minority recruiters. And they'd be agnostic as to whether it be for a state trooper, sheriff, or city police officer, but especially to start reaching young people, even younger than high school, to let them know about the opportunities out there. So that, but we're going to have to fund it in order for that to work. But that's, I have a bill ready to go for the, or almost ready to go, not quite. We're still working on the language.
Representative Gorsuch, right on.
Well, we're thinking along the same pathway. Then that's that's good.
Yeah. Sorry to steal your time.
No, sir. Trooper always has time in my book, Representative Barker.
There you go.
So, as I talked earlier, I'm going to let the subject matter experts talk. The next one up is Captain Tom Worthy on technology. I will be around, and I'll be closing after our divisions and our groups talk to you. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williams, Co-Chair Shields, and members of the committee. My name is Tom Worthy. I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police, and I've been employed with OSP for 21 years now. I'm here to discuss with you Oregon State Police's efforts in the area of technology implementation and use on our agency. And in this presentation, I'm going to talk to you about our approach to IT priorities and technology projects, as well as four major projects that we have either undertaken and completed or are in various stages of completion right now. Important for me to point out to you at this early stage that much of what you've heard and talked about already has been about data and real metrics that we can provide to you. Those are a product of our information technology projects, and so that's a real benefit both to you and to us as an agency, as well as the people of Oregon, to be able to answer difficult questions with real data and metrics. So even as we go forward with the other subject matter experts, you'll continue to hear them using data and metrics, which are derived from these systems that I'm about to talk to you about. So I mentioned that I would speak about our technology priorities, and these are really our guiding principles of how we like to approach the use of technology across our agency. We really have three major areas that we try to address with every project, and that's to modernize the agency, standardize our operations, and engage and enable. And I'll talk in a little bit more depth about each of those. OSP, at the time that we began to implement these projects, was behind the power curve for law enforcement technology. In the last several years, we've really caught up and began to engage the practice at the current level. We had projects that introduced a new computer-aided dispatch system as well as a records management system and an enterprise service bus to marry our systems together. Those projects were delivered and are in use now. And in fact, the CAD and RMS are source systems for a lot of the data that we've already been talking about here today. Also, in our systems modernization, we are ever present and vigilant in our efforts for system security. Police departments and agencies, all agencies across Oregon, can sometimes be the targets of nefarious hackers who wish to do our systems harm, and our staff works daily to prevent that type of activity. We wanted to standardize the way we use technology across the agency and have consistent operations from all corners of the state, and we've accomplished that with a standard records management system and computer-aided dispatch, as well as that user interface and a couple of the other projects that I'm about to talk to you about. We wanted to also make sure that we were making the maximum use of the systems that we have in place, rather than buying a robust system that can do a lot of different things and only using it for one thing. It's roughly akin to only driving your patrol car in second gear. You wouldn't do that, and you want to make the most use of it. So we strive to do that every day in our projects as well. And lastly, engage and enable. And what we mean there is that we want to connect our systems both internally and externally around the department. So a system that has one portion of a records life cycle can communicate with the next system. For instance, our computer-aided dispatch system is the first point of contact for the agency on a call for service. That will generate a record, and that record flows into our records management system. So the work that the dispatcher has already done adds to what the trooper is going to accomplish down the road. If there's a person, a witness, a victim, or a suspect that has been added in, then that is already in there and it's existing for the officer by the time they get to the records management system to begin to create that report. We want to be able to use our systems to share data with our partners as well. Our CAD system is now connected with several other computer-aided dispatch systems around the state, and can electronically transfer calls rather than picking up the phone and one dispatcher talks to another, and it almost becomes a game of whispers where one person's telling the data to another person. They can intake that data and pass it electronically to the partner agency. And we can use these systems, lastly, to deliver data, like I mentioned before. And that helps us as an agency to tell our story, and it also lets us and the leadership of the agency make critical decisions about where are we needed and what are we doing when we're there. And we can answer those questions through the use of these systems. I mentioned that I had four projects to present, and the superintendent already mentioned the Crime View Replacement Project. This is a large project, and to be upfront with you, it's a risky project, but we know as an agency that we can mitigate that risk through proper project controls. And we are working with our partners, both at LFO, DAS, Office of the CIO, and our Strategic Technology Officer, to initiate this project. This project is going to go through the full DAS stage gate process, and although it feels like a project already to us because we've been working on it for about 2 years, and we're about to approach the first gate in that process, and we'll either be allowed to continue or ask for additional documentation. And in this replacement of this system, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a moment, we're really looking for a commercial off-the-shelf solution. We don't have any desire to go out and try and program this thing on our own. There are vendors in this market space that provide this type of system. There's about five that we're aware of. And our charge is to pick the one that best meets the needs of the business and then get into a position where it's supported and it's contracted appropriately, that system will always be available and meet the needs of the business. And the business is, in this case, definitively not just OSP. It's many, many more people than that, from judges to prosecutors, regulatory agencies, and others, as well as police and sheriff's departments. The CrimeView system is the only repository for criminal history data in Oregon. It's essentially a large database in that regard. It also includes, in front of it, it's a miniature system of systems. So while it's also a database, it's programming on top of that to tell the database what information to return. And there's a message switch component as well. And the message switch is what connects Oregon with the rest of the nation and internationally. When we run a query on a person that we encounter in the field, that query at our message switch is broken out to also run out to the servers in Lyon, France, and check Interpol and come back, and it does it in less than 2 seconds. It's actually kind of amazing. But the message switch also needs to be replaced.
Currently, how many Oregonians do we have in the data system?
In the criminal history database, Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, there are literally millions of records in there. I don't have the exact number on the top of my head. I'm sorry. The system also includes a series of what we know as hot files, and hot files are essentially flags or warnings to officers when they run a query, and that could be something like a protective order, a stalking order, a stolen vehicle record, or a wanted person. So that system also is within the scope of this project to be replaced. So three main components, the database, as well as the message switch and the hot files. The purpose of the project is to sustain our public safety information services for now and into the future, and to ensure easy access to the data for our law enforcement partners. The project replaces the system that's nearly 20 years old now, and in thinking of technology projects, it's always helpful to think of something technology related that we're all familiar with, like a cell phone, like what your cell phone looked like 20 years ago. That's what our system looks like if you had one, which we probably didn't. So it's in dire need of replacement. And then also, we need to be able to adapt to additional requirements that come to us as the CJIS agency representative to the FBI. Occasionally, they'll give us requirements that we need to change our system in certain ways. And right now, we're too inflexible to really achieve that quickly, and a new system would enable us to do that. We think that the outcome of this project would enable us to continue with near 100% uptime. Because if you think about a system that's as core as this to the criminal justice system, when's it really okay for it to be down? Really never. So this is a system that needs near 100% uptime. And we want to have increased functionality and then also maximize the usability and the user experience of our customers. So CrimeView is going to be a long, heavy lift for us. We're up to the challenge, and we're working with our partners to make it successful. Another project.
What's your estimated cost on this?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields. We think that the project can be achieved for about $12 million.
Total cost?
Over time, yes, sir.
Compared to what we looked at other places, that's a bargain. They have to do it, okay.
The next project that I want to bring to your attention is our mobile data terminal modernization project. As I told you last time I was before the committee, OSP implemented a mobility project. In today's society, it's the expectation that a lot of data be at your fingertips quickly, and OSP wasn't in a position previous to that to really realize the benefits that other agencies had had for a long time. Our Panasonic CF19 Toughbook computers, which is very industry standard, you see them in a lot of patrol cars out there, are reaching end of life. The industry of mobile computing has changed as well. So now you won't see folks running around so much with laptops as tablets. So tablet computing has become big and urgent for us. It's the added better user experience, quicker boot up, and greater degree of portability that really makes it a more attractive solution for us. So what's depicted in this picture is, it's a pretty busy picture, but that's the interior of a OSP patrol car with the new Fujitsu Q704. It's a semi-ruggedized Windows 7 tablet, which is what we're installing now. Like I said, it replaces a Panasonic CF19, and this device easily docks in the patrol car and then also in the office, so the officers can get added usability out of it by taking it right from their mobile office into their stationary office and continuing their work.
Senator Wynn.
Are they in all the cars?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, not yet. We're within the midst of a rollout. We are mostly done with East Region, and then we're going to work our way through Southwest Region and up north to complete.
So when will you complete the to have them in all the cars?
With if plans stay on track, it'll be within the upcoming biennium. So right now, Fish and Wildlife has purchased 66, and Patrol Division has 147. There's 213 that are going to be equipping the East Region to begin with.
Representative Gorsuch.
So this system works in terms of getting data and information in the police car. But You can also do your reports, word processing, all of that on this system as well. Is that right?
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, and members of the committee, Representative Gorsuch. Yes, sir. This is a true mobile office. It's a little hard to see there, but there are multiple icons running on that computer right now. What's on the screen is their web outlook, and they're actually looking at an email for National Law Enforcement Week. The small blue icon on the bottom is their mobile CAD interface, which is where they can run checks and communicate with their dispatcher. If they see a car that looks suspicious, they don't need to jump on the radio. They can punch in a license plate and run that check. And then also there's access to a records management system mobile client that's streamlined for the field use, and it's optimized for the touch screen that exists on these as well, so they can actually submit their reports right from the car.
And do you also have like some agencies where pending calls and all of those things are also available on that in the car?
So only within OSP's calls. So this is okay. Communicating with our CAD system,
right.
And then if that needs to be moved off to another agency or communicated to another 911 center, that needs to go through our dispatch.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just allow officers to finish the report and all their paperwork. When they finish their shift, they get to go home, or they're going to sit down and spend an hour, hour and a half with this machine trying to get things done. Because they have time on their shift usually to get things done, wrapped up, and they can go home.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, and members of the committee, primarily they can do just about anything in the car that they can do at the office. It's full Windows suite. It's got Microsoft Office, Excel, every tool that they should need to be able to produce their report, and they do that on duty time.
Just a quick follow-up. Knowing the stress they're under and the hours they're working, can they get it done on an eight-hour shift, generally speaking?
Representative Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, it sort of depends on the volume of the type of the case, but generally speaking, it's possible to complete your reports on your shift.
Thank you.
And Co-Chair, mm-hmm. How much of this is a step up from where you were? Because the last time I did a ride-along, I think I came back and said that we needed to upgrade all your equipment.
So Senator Shields and Representative Williamson, members of the committee, Senator Winters, this is, the industry of technology
sounds
is moving
like Devlin.
Incredibly rapid right now, and this is a step up from where we've been before. The equipment's, it's new, it's usable, and we, at every step of the way, we concern ourselves with how does this affect and impact the trooper in the car, because they've got to sit in it for 8 to 10 hours or more every day and complete their reports.
Colleagues, and I'll do another ride-along to make certain that it is the step up. I did a ride-along, and I also did a ride-along with the city of Salem, so I could do a comparison on what was available by our city officers versus our troopers, and I came back and I was appalled at not the troopers but at us, and not providing the resources and the equipment that are sorely needed for our state troopers. We put them out not only on the highways, but some of them are on the byways, and then looking at the ability for them to actually do some of the new communication and connection and whatever. I felt that we were derelict, not you, in giving them the resources that they needed in order to have the kinds of equipment that they needed to do their job. So that's why I ask you the question.
So we have about 2 minutes left. So if this is a good stopping point, we could stop here, or if within 2 minutes you're going to get to a good stopping point.
Co-Chair Williamson, I think I can get there.
Okay.
Last note on this deployment is our eyes are open. We know there's going to be challenges ahead of us, and we're going to address those as they come up. And when the troopers do bring a concern to our attention, we're going to deal with it. So next project, quickly, I mentioned that one of our priorities was to connect systems together. And we had a need on the agency to be able to extract data from multiple different systems, from CAD, RMS, and others. Time activity and sex offender registration and some other disparate databases that weren't connected. So we undertook a data warehouse project to bring those together so we can observe the life cycle of a record as it goes from one system to the other and ultimately out to our partners. The data and st- statistics that you've heard already this afternoon came out of the data warehouse. It's a project that was successful and we've completed. Last project, I mentioned that we wanted to make sure that we got the most out of our systems that we had in place. OSP was a Laserfish shop customer. We used it, but it was siloed within the agency, meaning that there was no standardized naming conventions between work units and no standardized organizational file structure or user directory. So we've addressed that, went through a full Laserfish project, brought those units together and expanded the use of Laserfish, and completed this project recently as well. That's all I have. I'm happy to take questions.
Are there any questions? All right, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5531, the Oregon State Police budget, and we will be back here tomorrow to continue the presentation. Thank you. With that, we'll adjourn. With that, we'll adjourn.